Hi, and welcome to the Norwalk Hour for Wednesday, October 2nd. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll begin with a front-page article headlined, Mapping 50 School Threats Across the State. This article by Liz Hardaway. In a span of about 3 weeks, Connecticut schools have seen 50 instances of reported threats resulting in police investigations, increased security and lockdowns, delays and closures, a Connecticut Insider tally shows. The 50 incidents span across the state and have impacted some school districts multiple times. Fairfield, Norwalk, Norwich, Waterbury, and Winsted have each seen 3 incidents, and 9 other municipalities have each seen 2 incidents. The tally is based on incidents reported to the media from September 4th until the end of the month. It remains unknown whether other threats were investigated in Connecticut and not reported publicly during that period. The incidents have also resulted in criminal charges for 20 people, many of whom were described as juveniles. Police departments in Connecticut have determined many of the threats were not credible, but they have still brought about fear and anxiety to communities throughout the state. The recent surge in school threats in Connecticut and nationwide began after a 14-year-old student opened fire at a high school in Georgia, killing 4 and injuring 9 on September 4th. In a recent statement, Connecticut State Police said in the aftermath of legitimate school incidents that result in widespread media coverage, authorities often receive reports of copycat incidents or threats, many of which are later determined to be not credible. In Connecticut, reports show that no 2 incidents are identical. The threats, spanning from September 4th to September 27th, have targeted high schools, middle schools, and even elementary schools, while some have been broad, encompassing multiple schools and prompting widespread responses. Many of the threats in Connecticut during this period have been spread through social media platforms, though some were called in, or in one case, in the form of vandalism in a high school bathroom. Incidents resulting in arrests also have varied. One juvenile was arrested after police said they threatened to open fire at a Friday night football game between Norwich Free Academy and Fairfield Ward High School, prompting authorities to evacuate the area. In another arrest, a 17-year-old from Vernon is accused of making bomb and swatting threats in several Connecticut communities and is suspected of being part of a violent online group. Police said that the investigation into that teen started a year ago, well before the recent surge in school threats. Some incidents have not resulted in arrests. Experts said school districts often don't decide to prosecute because they are dealing with students and want to try to address the behavior. Students can face other consequences as well, such as suspension or expulsion. Christopher Trombley, the interim dean of Southern Connecticut State University's College of Education, fears that policymakers may overcorrect trying to address this behavior by implementing harsh consequences. This could alienate students, making them not feel comfortable speaking to an adult about legitimate concerns. It's not security guards, it's not metal detectors that keep schools safe, Trombley said. It's kids knowing and being known by the other grown-ups in the school. These incidents have caused disruptions such as lockdowns, delays, and closures in several school communities while police departments conducted investigations. Even when threats don't result in any physical injuries, students and teachers are still being exposed to a crisis because school personnel and police are responding to the threats as though they are legitimate, according to Amory Bernhardt, the director of Connecticut Center for School Safety and Crisis Preparation at Western Connecticut State University. Even if it's false information, these school personnel are responding as if it is a threat, Bernhardt said recently. They're getting exposed. This is crisis exposure for them. In a front-page article by Catherine Lutke, Norwalk couple's kayak trip changed Manresa Island's fate. The future of the coastal city of Norwalk will indelibly be changed by the generosity of 2 locals, Austin and Allison McCord, who took a kayak trip around Manresa Island and envisioned a park. A few years ago, Austin and I spent an afternoon kayaking around Manresa, said Allison McCord, in front of the decommissioned power plant on Manresa Island on Tuesday morning. We couldn't come on the property, but even from the water, you saw potential and said to each other, this would make an amazing park. Like many Norwalkers, the McCords enjoy nature and saw the decommissioned power plant on 125 acres of private land as a waste of beautiful shoreline. Unlike most people, the McCords are in a financial position to enact deep change. As the founder of Datto, a unicorn cybersecurity company that sold for about $1.5 billion in 2017, Austin McCord has income to spare. Back on land, the McCords began making calls, and to their surprise, heard, it's not a no. Those calls led to the couple to take a tour of the property and power plant with the current owners, Argent Ventures. It's absolutely overwhelming, and I think almost everybody that comes here the first time is overwhelmed by the size of the site, Austin McCord said. Standing on the roof of the 70-year-old power plant overlooking Norwalk with views of Manhattan in the distance, the McCords had a vision of a park that preserves Norwalk's history and brings people together. We realized how special this project could be for the community, Allison McCord said. Through more calls, cold emails, and people taking them seriously, the McCords struck a deal with Argent Ventures, assembled a team of landscape experts, architects, lawyers, and community leaders to make a dream a reality. Somebody says it takes a village. As I look at this, it takes two people with incredible imagination and generosity, and that's Austin and Allison, said Governor Ned Lamont. The McCord's dream has long been shared among Norwalkers, state leaders, and environmentalists. What Allison and Austin are doing here is investing in the God-given beauty of this planet, and this will be a symbol of what we can do to reclaim our natural resources when man has done so much to destroy them, said U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Home to a former coal and then oil-burning power plant, Manresa Island has been scarred by mankind and left dormant for 10 years following the closure of the power plant in 2013. The power plant was once Norwalk's greatest source of pollution, said State Senator Bob Duff of Norwalk. This will turn it from one of Norwalk's most colossal mistakes to one of Norwalk's greatest achievements, I believe, Duff said. It's a dream come true for Katie Dykes as the state's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Commissioner. It's so extraordinary to see such a happy ending for this energy facility, for the city of Norwalk, and for the entire state of Connecticut, Dykes said. The site will need years of remediation due to coal ash fields and other brownfields created because of the power plant. We understand that this is the beginning of a long journey ahead, Austin McCord said, but we're committed to go the distance, and we know that we've got a lot of work to do as far as remediation. The McCords founded the Manresa Island Corporation to oversee the project and brought on Jessica Vonoshek, Norwalk's former director of economic and community development, as executive director. It's amazing to be able to work with folks who have the ability to give back to the community in such an amazing way and who genuinely want to give back, Vonoshek said. On the team, Scape Landscape Architecture plans to heal and shape the park so that it can be enjoyed by all, said founding partner Kate Orff. The iconic blue power plant building has been reimagined by design architecture firm Jark Ingels Group, BIG, to include a community event space, pools, and an education center. Both Scape and BIG said their first step is to engage the community in the vision for what Manresa will become. We now have the chance to reimagine it for the 21st century with nearly 2 miles of new waterfront, Allison McCord said. We're creating an asset that we hope will last for generations. As nature lovers, we're excited to see kids explore the shoreline, families make lasting memories, and individuals find peace and inspiration. Most of all, the McCord said they look forward to bringing their dog, Maple, to the park. Around Fairfield County, Wilton artists are enraged at Gilbert and Bennett Cultural Center closure. This front page article by Caitlin Lyle. A decision by municipal leaders to close the town-owned Gilbert and Bennett Cultural Center building for health and safety concerns has enraged its tenants and community leaders. "They're furious," Pat Hegnauer, director of the G&B Cultural Center, said of the artists who rent space at the 49 New Street building. "And I've had to hold them off from going down and drawing blood." The G&B Foundation, a nonprofit organization that supports the visual and performing arts in a local and collaborative manner, manages the building, which was once Gilbert and Bennett School. The Cultural Center offers music and visual arts workshops, space to rent for meetings and events, and hosts exhibits, concerts, and demonstrations, among other programming, according to its website. The town of Wilton told all of the tenants on September 4th that they and their equipment must be vacated from the building on or before October 4th for health reasons, Hegenauer said. After the August 18th rainstorm that caused damage throughout the region, First Selectwoman Tony Boucher said the town's health department conducted an assessment of all municipal buildings and deemed the G&B Cultural Center not to be occupied for health reasons. "We just have to secure the building because it's not healthy for it to have occupants," Boucher said. "We just have to address the health and safety concerns." Boucher confirmed the building will close after we allow folks to take whatever belongs to them, though she could not confirm whether the closure was temporary or permanent. The heavy rain on August 18th certainly exacerbated the deteriorating conditions of the building, said Matt Knickerbocker, Wilton's town administrator, with leaks in the building's roof and water in the basement, among other issues. Hegnauer blamed the damage to the G&B building on long-term neglect by the town. "If they had maintained the building properly, with minimal maintenance regularly, this wouldn't have happened," she said. "The town does not manage the building," Boucher said, "but works to repair anything that's considered a fire hazard, as well as building issues such as leaking pipes." The town's engineering department is working with architects to examine the building and determine what it will cost to remediate the deteriorating conditions, including the roof, the pipes, and the ventilation system. "Do we have concrete plans? No, but we are studying it and putting together some quotes," Knickerbocker said. The closure had prompted fears from community members that the town would sell the building. "There's been some terrible mismanagement of the building over the years," said Heidi Holzer, who runs two businesses out of the building at 49 New Street. "It shouldn't be dumped into the public domain for a profit by the town of Wilton because they don't want to deal with the remaining remediation, and they've neglected the building for so long." But Boucher denied that the town is considering selling the cultural center, though although Wilton has previously received inquiries from groups interested in purchasing the building. "There is no sale at this time, nor do I foresee a sale right now," she said. "The only thing we see is a condition of deterioration in the building that makes it a health hazard for people to be in it." A previous analysis of the building found it would take $2 million to $3 million to repair and bring the structure to code, Boucher said. "It's something the town does not have the funds for," she said. "At this point, the town has no prospects for a sale, nor does it have the funds to bring it up to code." Constructed in 1915, the former Gilbert and Bennett School building was constructed as a state-of-the-art facility for Gilbert and Bennett Company employees and served the local community until the 1970s, when it could no longer meet the needs of the growing population, according to the G&B Cultural Center website. The building was leased to several small private preschools and sat empty until the Georgetown Community Association worked to preserve the building on the National Register of Historic Places, according to the website. The building was transformed into the G&B Cultural Center 15 years ago as a venue that supports anybody that wants to be creative, Hegnauer said. "There are about 28 artists who pay to use the building by the hour, along with 15 artists who rent studio space per day," she said. "Those rental fees are paid to the G&B Foundation, not the town," Knickerbocker said. "The building's artists and business owners are working to find new homes and empty their studios, which is a great difficulty," Hegnauer said. "It's a monumental job that should take a few months that I'm forced to do in a few weeks," she said. Holzer said they are mounting efforts to keep the building within the community. Also in Wilton, police say a Stratford man falsely reported a gunman at a Wilton parade. This article by Jessica Bravo. A Stratford man is facing charges after police say he falsely reported a gunman at a peace parade in town this year. Lewis Reed is charged with second-degree false incident report, the Wilton Police Department said, and was arrested on Saturday. Reed called at 911 on May 18th and said there was a male carrying a long gun near the March for Peace parade, police said. Reed is free on bond and is to appear at State Superior Court in Stamford on October 8th. In Westport, school redistricting plan could affect more than 80 students. This front-page article by Brian Gioielli. The school district is considering implementing a two-phase redistricting plan that would affect more than 80 students at Long Lights and Kings Highway Elementary Schools. The Board of Education last week approved Superintendent Thomas Scarese's plan, which calls for Phase 1 to be completed for the 2025-26 school year. Phase 2 would be completed for September 2027, or when the new Long Lots Elementary School opens. Phase 1 would see roughly 51 Long Lots students move to Saugatuck Elementary School. Phase 2 will move some 36 Kings Highway students to Coleytown Elementary School. We're not in a crisis state, Scarese told the board, adding that this move is to allow for equitable distribution of resources to all elementary-age students. The board is expected to vote on the redistricting plan in November to allow enough time for implementation, according to Scarese. The plan, as presented at this time, maintains the Greens Farms Elementary School's boundaries. Scarese stated that the district will continue to monitor Greens Farms enrollment trends in 2025 and 2026 and consider redistricting some 33 students to Saugatuck Elementary later, if necessary. Scarese said that the board has identified redistricting as a tool to balance utilization across the five elementary schools and to prepare for a likely enrollment increase at Long Lots Elementary School following the opening of the new construction in September 2027. Scarese said that the redistricting reduces enrollment pressures at Long Lots and utilizes space at Saugatuck Elementary. While enrollment is slightly lower at Long Lots and overall district-wide, Scarese said that Long Lots would be losing its two modulars at the end of this school year. We need to take modest actions to balance everything, Scarese said. That is no solace to the families being impacted. I'm sorry about that, but the board has charged the administration with goals to balance enrollment across elementary schools, he added. Board member Robert Harrington said, moving students is always difficult, but the enrollment pressures at Long Lots and Kings Highway, in his opinion, are only going to worsen and require proactive action. They are imbalanced, Harrington said about Long Lots and Kings Highway, and there is space at an excellent school. Demographers like Mike Zuba and Pat Gallagher of MP Planning Group presented the redistricting plan at the board's September 19th meeting. The plan also calls for infrared technology classrooms to remain in place at Greens Farms and Long Lots in Phase 1. Phase 2 states that Coleytown will be reconfigured to a 4.5 section per grade school with 27 grade-level instructional classrooms and a planning capacity of 536 students. Long Lots presently uses two modulars, but they will not be available after this school year. The present school has 29 classrooms enrolled, and the one to be built will have 30 classrooms. Without redistricting, the need could call for as many as 33. What that could mean without redistricting, according to school officials, is holding music instruction in a hallway, art on a cart, and combining special education and math and literacy interventionists into singular rooms to find more class space. Scarese said his biggest concern is no additional classroom space prevents him from adding sections to reduce class sizes if needed. Long Lots principal Kim Ambrosio said, at present, Art is taught in the regular classroom, and Spanish has no designated classroom. The former art room has been repurposed to smaller spaces for literacy and math intervention areas. There's also no computer lab. That is embedded in the library. Needing three more classrooms would be very impactful to the school, Ambrosio said to the board. In a front-page article by John Moritz, attitudes on Gaza is percolating into Connecticut elections. With the nearly year-old war between Israel and Hamas threatening to spill over into a wider regional conflict, voters thousands of miles away in Connecticut are watching the fallout from the crisis both locally and in Washington as they prepare to head to the polls in a little over a month. Over the past year, protests for the Palestinian cause have managed to disrupt events such as Governor Ned Lamont's State of the State Address, city government meetings, and local appearances by members of Congress. Whether that discontent creates a noticeable electoral shift, however, remains to be seen. Democrats have dominated the last few elections up and down the ballot in Connecticut, sweeping all federal and statewide elected offices. Few expect this year to be an exception, as Democratic nominee and Vice President Kamala Harris is heavily favored to carry the state over former President and Republican nominee Donald Trump. My sense is the top priorities for people in this election are about issues here at home, said U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, who's running for re-election in November. Obviously, the situation in the Middle East is incredibly dangerous and heartbreaking, he added. Not everybody in Connecticut is following it, but many people are, and I think that debate between Harris and Trump, Harris looked like a commander-in-chief, and Trump looked confused and a little delusional. Some Democrats, however, have sought to vent their frustration with President Joe Biden's handling of the conflict and continued military support for Israel by threatening to withhold their support at the ballot box. In April, those efforts manifested through a movement to signal wider dissatisfaction with the Biden administration by voting uncommitted in the state's Democratic primary. After Biden dropped out of the race in July, activists in the uncommitted movement turned their attention toward Harris and getting a slot for a Palestinian-American speaker at the DNC, an effort that the Democrats ultimately rebuffed. As a result, in Connecticut, a group called Justice for Palestine in Congress is urging voters to back a slate of minor party and write-in candidates in each of the state's five congressional districts, as well as the U.S. Senate race. We are trying to establish some electoral discipline, and there are red lines that cannot be crossed, said Omar Scott Antar, a volunteer with the group. Genocide is a very clear red line. Antar said the group is also backing Green Party candidate Alice Leibowitz in the state's 29th Senate District, covering the University of Connecticut campus and stores, in order to pressure the incumbent, Senator May Flexer of Killingly, and the university over its response to student protests against the ongoing war. One local elected Democrat who has bucked the party over the issue is Representative Keith Denning of Wilton, who said that his experience working on medical missions in Gaza and the West Bank caused him to question the United States' continued support of Israel's military campaign. In my opinion, Harris hasn't made a strong enough stance for what she would do differently than Biden, Denning said. I think there's a lot of voters who are divided. They don't want Trump to win, but they don't feel like they're being heard in the Democratic Party. Democrats have also faced pressure from Republicans for appearing not to sufficiently support Israel or calling for a ceasefire deal to the conflict in the region. Murphy, an influential member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has seen his stances on various Middle Eastern issues, including his support for the Iran nuclear deal and opposition to the designation of Yemen's Houthi movement as a terrorist organization, become a target of criticism from his Republican opponent, Manchester businessman Matthew Corey. After the U.S. announced this week that it would be deploying additional troops to the region following Israeli attacks on Hezbollah within Lebanon, Corey took to X, the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, saying, "These events are of great concern, and specifically troubling to Lebanese communities in the area around Danbury and Waterbury." Murphy told CT Insider last week that he had little concern over Corey's attacks, adding that electoral considerations had not factored into his decision-making in that area. "I make my mind on national security issues based on what I think is good for the country," Murphy said. "I don't think about the impact that my decisions have on elections or politics. I think that's just the right way to do the job." In other news, pick your own apple crop is much better than last year's. This article by Jesse Leavenworth. Connecticut apple growers are heading into the October pick-your-own season with abundant and healthy crops after devastating losses last year. At DeFazio Orchard and Greenhouses in Killingly, hail destroyed about 90% of the emerging fruit in 2023, Orchard co-owner Kate DeFazio said on Monday. The pick-your-own business at the 80-acre farm, which also includes peaches and pears, constitutes at least half of the farm's annual revenue, DeFazio said. This year, the honey crisps have already been about picked clean, but the orchard is still offering plenty of choices for do-it-yourself pickers, including late varieties such as Golden Delicious and Granny Smith that will be ready to pluck in mid-October. Across the state, things are looking really good for pick-your-own orchards, with a good crop and pleasant weather for meandering through the rows. Evan Lentz, a specialist and educator in fruit production at UConn's Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture, said on Monday, "Apples are among the state's major commodities. Connecticut hosts 296 apple producers on 1,917 acres, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The annual market value of all fruits, tree nuts, and berries in the state totals $36.9 million, according to the agency's latest figures. Last year, fruit and vegetable farmers suffered losses totaling about $30 million due to a sub-zero freeze in February that devastated the peach crop. A mid-May frost that cut deeply into apple production, hail and heavy rainfall in July," Lent said. "The heavy frost forced some orchards, including Johnny Appleseed's farm in Ellington and Scantic Valley Farms in Summers, to cancel their pick-your-own seasons. Except for some low-lying areas, Lyman Orchards in Middlefield escaped the worst of the frost damage," Executive Vice President John Lyman said. "However, the Arctic freeze last February destroyed about 90% of the peach crop. This year's apple crop is a bit lighter than last year's, but still really nice," Lyman said. A family enterprise since 1741, apple trees cover about 100 acres. About 5% of the orchard is replanted each year, Lyman said. Most apple orchards in the state have diverse offerings, including other pick-your-own fruits and berries, cider, baked goods, pumpkins, petting zoos, corn mazes, and haunted hay rides. Apples came with European settlers and have been grown in Connecticut since colonial times. Relatively mild winters, soils that are not too sandy or heavy, and adequate precipitation make the state suitable for apple growing," Lent said. "Some trees are over 75 years old and still producing fruit," he said. Pick-your-own apples can differ from apples sold in grocery stores where managers seek the largest and most blemish-free fruits," Lent said. Asked what happens to all those apples that fall to the ground, he said some orchards had used them for cider, but current rules prohibit drops from being processed for consumption. Farmers say they let the drop fruits lie and feed them into the soil to help nourish next year's crop. State Agriculture Commissioner Brian Hurlbritz encouraged people to visit ctgrown.org to find a nearby orchard. "Fall is a wonderful time to take part in activities throughout Connecticut, including apple picking at our orchards," Herbert said. "We have more than 60 orchards offering pick-your-own apples, plus apple cider, cider donuts, and more seasonal favorites." Finally today in Life Tributes, Francis J. Kaplan passed away in Virginia on September 30th. And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and you've been listening to the Wednesday, October 2nd edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.